Welcome to Access Astrology.
My name is Alison Price and I'm here with my good friend Arwen O'Neill, and we're coming to you from Vancouver, Canada. The podcast period for this session is June the 1st to the 14th. We're going to have a little bit of discussion about the transits going on. We have some conversation about the moon phases. And this time we have a very special guest from Washington State, Nina Griffin. Welcome, Nina.
Hey, thank you very much, Alison. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Nina. Thanks, Alison. So we're going to start out with the transits for June 1st through 14th, 2014. And so the first thing we've got going on Tuesday the 3rd, we're going to have the Sun quincunx or in conjunct to Pluto. And so what this transit means is that needed changes might meet with ego resistance or difficulty relinquishing control. You might have to step back and change your plans and maybe, you know, not take things so personally for a couple of days, focusing around that time. And also on the same day, we've got Venus sextile Neptune, which is a nice agreeable aspect. It's receptivity to beauty, art, and music, maybe stimulates creativity and artistic impulses. It's an imaginative, inspiring aspect.
Okay.
Yeah. So a couple days later, on the Thursday, we've got the Sun sextile Uranus, which is also pretty agreeable, but in a different way. It's introduction of reforms and improvements, maybe, innovations. Consult your astrologers, what I've got written down in my notes.
That's right. Consult your astrologers.
Yeah. You can take advantage of the flowing aspects that way. So the next day, we've got Mercury going retrograde, which is... Alison's clapping, I'm not sure why. This is the second one this year. It seems like we just got out of the last one.
I know. It's the second Mercury retrograde. Well, we're in June now.
I know. It seems like it just yesterday.
Do you not like Mercury retrograde?
Oh, well, as a Virgo, I don't think it's, you know, it's not the best thing. But okay. It doesn't affect me as much either. I kind of like it. I like it when the world slows down so I can just kind of chill and, you know, observe without, you know.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And then we've got Venus in conjunct or quincunx Mars, which is, let's see, my notes say wanting to be liked versus being direct can be an issue at this time. And knowing when to confront or capitulate might be a question you have.
And of course that's on a Friday, so we always look at that as what I do. Is that a date night? It's not going to be a good date.
It's not going to be a good date, no.
Okay.
But, you know, give it a try anyway.
Yeah, perhaps not a good night to have that important talk with your significant other, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, or your boss.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Always bringing in the financial, you know, aspect of the Venus one.
Yeah, he's going to say, why do you spend all the money?
But I'm worth it, is what you'll say.
Okay.
Okay, so then the 8th is a Sunday, and we have the Sun, quincunx, or in conjunct. I'm going to have to choose
you're
one.
You're into these. You know you're...
I know.
Get on the fence.
This one is Sun and Saturn in conjunct each other. So doubts, regrets over past failures undermine confidence and self-expression, possibly. You know,
okay.
Could be something to watch for. And then we also have Venus trine Pluto, which is an interesting one. Intense attractions, irresistible compulsions, feelings in relationships may intensify at this time. Interesting.
And actually what's interesting is because, I mean, this period you're bringing up, we've had three quincunxes already.
I know.
And because the mood, when I'm just looking at our calendar here in front of me in the recording studio, with the Sun quincunx Pluto and the Sun quincunx Saturn, we know those two are sextile, right? So it's forming a yard to the Sun during those 2 weeks, which, quite honestly, I hadn't even noticed.
What did you do in the math over there?
Well, because you can see that there are two quincunxing the Sun, and the other, we know the other two are sextile.
Sure.
So it's called...
It's a
finger
yard.
Of God.
It is, yeah.
To the Sun. So how interesting.
Interesting indeed.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, if you feel a little put upon that weekend... No one could blame you. That's what I'm getting out of that one.
Yes.
So the very next day, we've got Neptune going retrograde until November 6th, which is quite a long time. Obviously, it's a giant planet. It's, you know, one of the outer planets. I don't actually have anything notes-wise about this. I guess any kind of retrograde period is just sort of, you know, stalled or blocked action of that planet. And Neptune, of course, being the planet of dreams, delusions, glamour, these things may be blocked. I don't know. I don't know what to say about that one, but it's happening.
Okay.
All right. So then on Thursday, we've got Venus opposite Saturn.
Yes.
Which is, let's see. Responsibility may override desires at this time. Emotions may be kept in check more than usual. Probably have more to say about that. Mm-hmm. Maybe. And the very next day, Friday the 13th, we've got Mars square Pluto.
Tough Friday, right?
yeah, really. Power struggles, ruthlessness, urges, and obsessions, accidents, and injuries are possible. So watch out on the road.
Okay, so it's quite a different kind of 2 week period. Often we've got a lot of variety of aspects, and here we just seem to have some tough ones and a few quincunxes coming up. So it just shows you the tone of the weeks as they're developing.
Yeah, definitely an active spring summer.
Yes.
Well, what's the moon doing?
Yes, well, the moon is always moving, as I say every time, it never stops. So during this period, we had the new moon in the week before our period started. So what we have now is that the moon is now growing in light. It's coming out of the darkness and moving towards the light. So on the Thursday, the 5th, we've got the first quarter in Virgo. So at that point, the moon will be able to see it in the sky. And as I say, it's in the waxing phase. So it's a good time to start things and get behind things you want to move forward during this 2 week period. So that's the first quarter on the 5th of June. And then as I turn my page, we have the full moon on the 12th of June. That's Thursday, the 12th of June at 22 Sagittarius. So it's a full moon in Sagittarius. And the sun is where at that stage in Gemini. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've got the full moon in Sagittarius, and each month we know the full moon moves along a sign. So this is the Sagittarian full moon. And you know, I don't really know what else to say about that at this stage. It's the height of the culmination. It's the fruition period of the moon cycle.
Nice.
So for this 2 weeks we're talking about now, we are growing in light.
Excellent.
So that's always a good thing.
Definitely.
So yeah.
So do we make anything of the Venus-Saturn opposition just at the moment of the new moon? The full moon?
Hmm.
It looks like they're just a couple minutes apart here, at least in my little ephemeris that I'm looking at. Venus is opposite Saturn at about 9:09 p.m. Pacific time, and the moon becomes full at 9:11 Pacific time.
Oh, wow. That's really
cool. I was curious, if you had anything to say about that.
Well, I'm not sure if the Saturn opposition Venus is connected to the moon by aspect.
I don't think so, because it's Venus and Saturn are in Taurus and Scorpio.
Mm. Yeah. So that Venus opposition Saturn already wants to tell me that there's going to be difficulties with, authority figures, I would want to say. Mm. You're being curtailed for whatever reason, or maybe you have to stay behind because you have to do your responsibility. This is the sort of aspect where the babysitter doesn't pitch up, so you can't go to the party. You have to stick to your duty and stay behind and look after whatever's at home for you. So that is in itself, because Saturn is in the opposition, to me is a contraction of what you could be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And this full moon in Sagittarius is a little bit of a hooligan sign, isn't it? Sagittarius.
Yeah.
So I would imagine some conflict. I don't know. It's going to depend on how it's connecting to your chart, I would have thought, Nina. Yeah.
It feels financial, mm-hmm. too, I think, too. Which are, Venus and Saturn both.
What do you think, Nina?
That would be my guess as well. When I saw that, it makes me think of, so the sun is going to be in Gemini, and so Saturn is going to be in the preceding sign, which to me gives the impression of some kind of hidden events or something like that going on. If we're sort of imaginarily putting that full moon opposition on the ascendant, then the Venus-Saturn opposition would be 6 to 12, which I've seen done sometimes. And so there might be perhaps behind-the-scenes financial issues going on, which perhaps block or somehow have an emotional difficulty, repercussions.
Yes, good point. Okay.
So speaking of that, I mean, that's a really good segue, because your one of your focuses, at least, is financial astrology, Nina.
That's right. I guess I would put it all in that plane, wouldn't I?
That's how it looks to me as well. I just don't have I don't have as much of a background in that specifically, but it is fascinating. And we would love to know more about that. In fact, if there's like a financial astrology elevator pitch.
I'll do my best. I'll tell you how I use it. I think financial astrology is something, it's a really big space. So maybe I'll give you a little bit of a flavor as to what it is and how different people practice it. And then I'll say a little bit about what I do. So financial astrology is really huge. It really encompasses people who are doing a lot of predictions in the stock market, people who do a lot of day trading. So they're queued up to the tiniest little stock market blips and therefore the tiniest little planetary blips that are very esoteric and very obscure methods. Mm-hmm. And you know, if that's your hobby, that's something that you will do. I know folks who have newsletters based on that, and again, they supposedly, you know, sell it to large institutions, and this is how they make their living. So there's definitely interest even from the non-astrology community, as long as you can, you know, as it can reliably make money. I think it doesn't matter how you do it, even if it's astrology.
Yeah.
But the financial astrology that I do more of is a little bit more personalized. So, of course, when I do a lot of natal astrology, not all of my clients, but a large portion of them will specifically want to know about financial issues in their lives and how it impacts them. And it's interesting. I think it's very revealing. And it's definitely, you know, we all have a lot of emotional issues and complexes around money, regardless of whether you have a lot of it or very little of it. It's just a very emotionally fraught issue for people. And so they do want to be counseled on that level, but also on a practical level, right? They want to understand what is the best time to do something. For example, when should they start their company or incorporate? Mm-hmm. Or how can they maybe bring a certain planetary energy to an existing business? So in that case, they might, for example, reincorporate, or they could launch a certain product at a certain time that might be very favorable. For example, I had a client who wanted to launch, he was in the soap business, like detergents, and they wanted to launch a new product. So, and they figured out that the people that would be buying this, for the most part, would be women, and he knew exactly the age segment and so on. So we looked for times that were very harmonious with the female planets, with the moon and Venus, as well as, of course, Jupiter, which is the money planet, and other things in his natal chart. So, you know, there's also kind of a marketing component, too, that seems to come into it pretty often.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. So have you always done that, or do you find that because it's been an interest of yours, your own actual chart attracted you towards financial astrology over and above other disciplines in astrology?
You know, I think I do. I would probably say about half of my work is financial in nature, and the other half is just about anything else that any astrologer might see in their practice. So I do a lot of other kinds of things, such as elections for weddings and things like that. And I do a lot of horary astrology, again, coming out of a traditional background. For your audience, some of whom might not know, horary is the art of casting a chart for the time that you understood a question and then divining that answer out of that horoscope. So you don't even use that person's natal chart for this method. I do a lot of that, and it lends itself to both financial questions, such as should I buy this stock on Monday to profit, but also any question you can imagine. Where did I put my wallet? Or is, you know, Mr. So-and-so going to marry me? Just about anything specific that you'd like answered.
So if someone wanted to get into financial astrology, if they were interested in studying or learning, you know, more about that, what would you recommend? What are the things they should know?
I think whatever, you know, I always say this with astrology is I think it's really helpful for people to have a sense of the pragmatic aspect of what they're interested in. So, for example, if you're interested in using it to predict the stock market, having an understanding of the stock market itself, even without astrological aspects of it, would be really helpful.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it sort of seems common sense, but I think sometimes people forget that and they get in over their heads a little bit because they don't have that subject matter expertise. So I think in that case, that's what I would start with. And then there are books. I think I recommended this in the Fraser Valley Astrology Guild interview that's on their website. They asked me a similar question, and I suggested a book by Bill Meridian. It's called Planetary Stock Trading.
Oh, wow.
I like his work. He's a portfolio manager, and he's been at this for a number of decades. And as I understand it, he's a Taurus, so his approach is very practical, very hands-on. Not a lot of hand-waving, which I really like. So that would be one place to start. I think he focuses mostly on the stock market. But for more the natal analysis, for example, you pretty much just go to traditional texts, such as I use William Lilly, the 17th century English astrologer. He was also a Taurus, and he spent a lot of time writing about money from a more natal perspective. There, it really just depends on how exactly you're planning to implement it.
Yeah, it's interesting how many Tauruses. One of our recent episodes was focused on Taurus, and we noticed William Randolph Hearst was a double Taurus, so was Karl Marx, so was Bernie Madoff.
Wow.
I mean, all these people that are just completely associated with
well, the bull is
with
the
money,
economy.
What was that?
The bull is the symbol.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, and the NYSE, the New York Stock Exchange chart, like the
that's so true.
Venus in Taurus on the midheaven, which is just the golden bull, you know, right there. Crazy. That's one of my favorite things about astrology, just those little weird things like that.
The symbolism keeps working at any level.
It does, yeah. Totally. Oh, well, speaking of that, so being a traditional astrologer, obviously, you know, the whole Uranus-Pluto square that's been making most modern astrologers crazed lately is probably not as much of a focus for yourself.
No, I am in an you know, on an island of my own serenity when it comes to the the Uranus square Pluto, I have to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's one of those things that's actually, I mean, it's helpful to look at. I'm not anti those planets.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to view them a little bit more like you might fixed stars.
Right.
So, for example, if they're conjunct something important, I tend to pay a little bit more attention. So if you have an eclipse that happens to be triggering these planets, I will definitely look at that. I just tend not to give them quite as much weight as I think some modern astrologers might. So that's really the main difference.
Yeah, I noticed that, I can't remember where I read it, but it was either on your website or in that interview with Fraser Valley, where you said that most of the time there will be some other correspondence in the chart that you're looking at, which will sort of reinforce whatever the outer planets would have been saying, had you been...
Exactly, and that's the beauty of astrology, is I think you'll often get a number of clues to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That's why I think the debate of should you use the outer planets or not, to me, is kind of moot. If you find them helpful, use them. To me, they're not strictly necessary, but... Again, that's very personal.
Yeah. The looming question for me is, do you see an imminent collapse of the stock market in in anything that, you know, that others are seeing, Uranus, Pluto, and, you know, the Grand Cardinal Cross? And
right.
A Mars
and we, of course,
Jupiter for
right.
You?
Right. You know, not as much as I guess I would have expected. I think, so there are a couple, I guess there are two answers to this, or two-pronged answer. So one is the Uranus-Pluto square. I think it definitely has shaken up the world economy in a number of ways. And I noticed it was very active with the U.S. with the discussions they had around the debt ceiling. That seemed to correspond very closely to the Uranus-Pluto dates. And, of course, it was difficult because a number of, well, the United States got their debt downgraded, which was pretty much unthinkable.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, is there really a long-term repercussion to that? I'm not so sure. And I think... Especially in the U.S., the political side seem to have backed away from it because they understand that everybody loses when they start pulling these kind of stunts. So, but as far as the Cardinal Grand Cross is concerned, I know that, of course, we had an eclipse not so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
What is it now? You know, a couple of weeks, I guess. And that triggered it, which, you know, as a traditional astrologer, we spend a lot of time worrying about eclipses.
Mm-hmm.
So we have our own things that's been, you know, that keep us awake at night.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we really did see sort of a tanking of the U.S. stock market around that time, though it seems to have been recovering since then. So I don't know that this is really it necessarily. I think actually the market might continue to do okay over the next probably 3 or so years. I mentioned this to someone at my talk in Vancouver, but I don't think I mentioned it on stage when I was speaking, so maybe I'll just repeat it very quickly.
Mm.
I used the work of a woman who was writing in the 1930s. Her name is Louise McWhirter. That's McWhirter. And she didn't get a whole lot of press, maybe because she was a woman writing in this field that is typically very male.
Yes.
But she spent a lot of time looking at the nodal cycle, which is 19 and a half years, I believe.
Yes.
Or is it 18 and a half? Yeah. And she correlated it to the U.S. economy and the stock market. And her methods are fairly broad brush because I think she didn't have that much data to work with.
Uh-huh.
But it's quite accurate. And basically she found that as the North Node passes backwards through the various signs, the economy goes up and down, and it goes up and down as a sine wave. So it means that whenever the node is in a certain sign, the economy is at its peak, and then when it's in the opposite sign, it is at its nadir. And I'm trying to remember what those signs are. I want to say the North Node in Leo is the best. It symbolizes the apex of the economy, after which things slowly start to go down. Mm-hmm. And the North Node in Aquarius is usually the nadir, or the worst part of the economy. And at least with this last U.S. housing crisis debacle, that definitely was very strongly correlated. So we are on an upswing now, and we will be probably, I want to say, until 2017, but I don't have the ephemeris in front of me that far ahead. So, yeah.
Yes, I've heard that about the actual real estate market and the nodal cycle.
Right, exactly. And I think that's where it came from. Yeah.
Yeah, the boom and bust, because most people want to say, yes, if you invest in housing, you can never lose. Well, clearly one can.
People did.
That's right. People did, and people always have, but people tend to hang in long enough so they may not have lost on what they've spent on it to what they got for it, but over the period they may have.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And the point I would bring up as well is I think this is where common sense comes in as well. You know, for example, if you live in a very hot area, such as Vancouver or San Francisco or New York, yes, you will still go through these cycles of boom and bust, but the overall trend is actually upward.
Yes.
So, you know, it's, again, like you said, Allison, it's all about your time horizon, really.
Yeah. It's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I was thinking about that last fall. My mother came up to visit, and the first thing that she noticed when she looked out my window at the view was all the cranes on the horizon, all the high-rise buildings going up.
All the condos, it's living space.
She's like, wow, there's no recession here, is there? And I must look that way from up here, you know? Like,
it's and right. Because you and I live here, we're wondering,
we hear about
who's
it.
Affording to get in these places?
And we hear all the, you know, the complaining from the real estate industry, but yeah. It's,
because I know a lot of these buildings, these condos that have been built here are... they're not full.
No.
Right. They are empty. And I understand this is an issue specifically in Vancouver. There's a ton of absentee ownership.
Oh, yeah.
Absentee. Yes, that's a good one.
They're called investment properties. That's
right.
In quotes.
Okay.
Well, yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, maybe I don't want to diverge sort of too far, but it's interesting because you do wonder to what extent that's helpful, because I know, for example, condos are not supposed to appreciate quite as much as houses just because of the nature of the living space.
Mm. Yeah.
But then if you're in a very hot market, perhaps that, you know, if you just wait till the next North Node in Leo or something,
exactly.
You might be able to get around all that.
I think there have been predictions of the condo market going back down, you know, for over a decade at least that I can think of. And, you know, it hasn't happened because Vancouver continues to be just so darn livable.
Oh, yeah, it's very desirable. Absolutely. Yeah.
Can't argue with that one.
That's right.
Yeah.
Nina, I was wondering, you were mentioning earlier about being a traditional astrologer. I wonder if you could explain that a little more for our listeners. Exactly what does that mean as compared to, say, a regular astrologer?
A regular astrologer, yes. So I think this is where it goes into what it means to me. A lot of people have very different interpretations of it. When I first started in, you know, I think as all of us, even who look more toward traditional techniques, we all started out as modern astrologers because that's just what's most readily available and accessible. When people say traditional astrology, most of the time they usually mean that you practice methods as they were practiced by, say, Alan Leo, who worked in Victorian England and turn of the century. So you're looking at about 100 years back, a little bit more. Nowadays, though, it seems to have changed a little bit, and we have such great access to a lot of older texts. There's been a lot of activity on the translation and republishing fronts. So we have a lot of traditional tends to now mean using pre-Enlightenment era methods. So for example, for me, I tend to use methods that are predominantly from the medieval eras, both in Europe and in the Islamic world, because the Muslims were heavily, heavily into astrology, astronomy, geometry, and math.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wrote a lot of astrology texts. And also Renaissance methods, which tend to arise mostly in England and in Italy. But some people, you know, when they say traditional, they really mean they're trying, or what they think is they're practicing Hellenistic astrology, which is probably 2,000 years old or so. Mm. But again, we don't have as many texts around that, which tends to make me a little bit more cautious about those methods, because I feel like we don't quite have a complete picture of what that astrology looks like.
They're all on stone tablets.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
So does that then influence your preference in house systems?
Mm.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I think to some extent it does, but mostly out of laziness than really any kind of rigorous thinking. So I use, for horary, I use Regiomontanus, which is what William Lilly used, and it was fine for him, so it's fine for me. Like I said, there's really no great reason for it. Okay. I've played around a little bit with the whole sign or sign house system, where, say, you know, if you have Leo rising, Leo is going to be the entire first house and so on. And aspects in that system are typically, that's the more Hellenistic style, where aspects are now between signs. So even if you have something at zero Leo and, I don't know, 29 Libra, it's still a sextile, basically, which it normally wouldn't be because of issues of orb and things like that. Right. So I've played around with that, but mainly I use Placidus and Regiomontanus. I think if I lived further up north somewhere in the far reaches of Canada or Alaska or something, I might go into whole sign. Because those unequal systems tend to really wreak havoc at those latitudes.
They're good when you don't have a birth time.
Exactly, that's right. Yes.
But then, just to be clear, a client coming to you would have a different approach to the astrology that perhaps a more modern astrologer would have, but they would certainly be able to get a full interpretation, yes?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, thank you for bringing that up too, Allison. You know, the main difference too in consultation is that a modern astrology, or what I would call 20th century astrology, kind of came up at the same time as psychotherapy did. And so I think it's very closely intertwined with that kind of approach to client needs. And I think it's very valid because it's, you know, Jung, as I'm sure you know, was heavily into things like astrology and divination. Yeah. So there's definitely room for those two disciplines meeting. But the traditional astrologers, there was a little bit of that. But of course, they were, you know, psychiatry didn't really exist, or psychology didn't as such. So there was much more focus on very concrete and pragmatic predictions and interpretation of what was going on with the client's life. There is less of a concern about, for example, that person's childhood or emotional issues that keep arising over and over. Yeah. Though I find in practice we do end up talking about that, just because those things do inform how somebody goes about their very practical life issues.
And that kind of, that kind of approach has really seeped into the culture just at large.
The psychological astrology.
Yeah. Just psychological, you know, the way of speaking about, you know, one's psychology.
Right. The sun sign is a little personality, which is actually a very new concept. And again, that definitely came up in the 20th century, partly as a result of Alan Leo, who I think, I understand he was probably the first, I don't know what I would call it, cookbook astrologer.
Yeah.
And
that
you know, when you would write, when you would write away to Alan Leo and you'd send in your, you know, £1 or 10 shillings or whatever it costs to get your horoscope done, there would actually, he would have helpers who would snip out pieces pre-made, you know, okay, so you have sun in Virgo, you have moon in Taurus, and they would put that all together and they would send that to you. So it's almost like, you know, like a computerized report, but done manually, of course.
Like a
database. So even to this day and age, we're still doing that. But that's not at all how a traditional astrologer in the old days would have approached it.
Right.
For the most part, people didn't know their birth times a lot of the time. So natal astrology was usually reserved for people wealthy enough and educated enough to have that kind of information.
Yeah, and
most
royalty.
People got horary. Yeah, yeah, and royalty, of course.
Because, of course, for them it was vitally important that
that's exactly right. Yeah.
I was noticing on your website the horoscope of the founding of Baghdad, and I was reading that actually just earlier today, and that's fascinating. I was wondering if mundane astrology is another interest of yours, or if that was sort of just something anomalous that you found interesting, or
right? Yeah. So mundane astrology is something I really love, and if I could find a way to make it into a sort of consultative thing, that would be great. Yeah. But I think that's not as frequent, since I don't serve any kings, you know. So.
Yes,
you know, and that's very fascinating because you're really looking at huge cycles, and it's the thing about mundane astrology is you really end up killing a lot of trees because you need a lot of charts. It can be very overwhelming, I think. I wrote a lengthy series of articles on my blog that eventually turned into an article for The Mountain Astrologer about Iran, and looking at their situation today compared to where they were at the time of the revolution in the 1970s. And they have a very interesting natal chart. So if that's of interest to you or your listeners, I think that would be
natal,
definitely.
Are you talking about the 1977 chart?
It's 1979, I believe. Yeah. So this one was when Khomeini, and this is what the chart is, a number of possible charts for founding, but the one that really seemed to work especially well is the one for Khomeini's arrival in Iran, which basically
the moment he stepped off the plane, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a great.
Maybe we can.
It's an awesome chart.
We'll
get Arwen to look that chart.
Yeah, it's also a fascinating. I've looked at it too. It's really interesting. I might have actually. Let's actually get the month and year of that article of yours, in case anyone wants to look back on the Mountain Astrologer, besides myself, which I'm pretty sure I read it, actually.
You know, it's 2012, but I'll have to look up the exact the exact month. Yeah. But it is 2012, and it basically does a number of years prediction, and it looks like, at least my approach at that time, I kind of saw this tension building year by year.
Yeah.
And so the next couple of years from now, from 2014, I think are going to be very much, you know, make or break for Iran. And there's going to be a lot of, you know, possible conflict and things like that. Part of the issue that they have as a country is that particular chart, the Khomeini disembarkation chart, has Moon in Aries on the ascendant.
Yeah.
And it just seems to get triggered very frequently. It's a very volatile kind of combination.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, obviously, it couldn't have been planned, but obviously, in that part of the world, so many
charts. It looked like it was. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at the chart for, not to start a whole thing, but if you look at the chart for Israel, it's one of the not similar in terms of the charts themselves, but just in terms of like looking at it and going, oh my God, that's incredible.
Right. It's very accurate.
It's one of the most recent national charts that we have, obviously. But when we have, you know, right to the minute of when they were considered to be, you know, the nation was born, you know. Both of those charts are phenomenal. Just they speak to you.
Yes, I was quite interested in mundane astrology.
Yeah. Allison, slightly less so, but
I try and keep up.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, and I'm sure, as you know. Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to add one more thing, that's all right. Yeah, so just before we get off the mundane topic, I worked on a study in 2012 that I presented at the United Astrology Congress in New Orleans about predicting who the next U.S. president is going to be, because, you know, that's always a matter of vital interest to everyone. This was in 2012 when we had our election, but I basically worked out a method that you can use any following year. Oh. It involves looking at the Aries ingress, which is the chart for the moment that the sun enters Aries, beginning of the astrological year. And so what ends up happening is you can basically tell whether the current party will stay in power or whether it will change. So you may not necessarily know the person's identity if you're looking at it, you know, 8 years from now when you don't know who the candidates will be, but you can actually track the change in parties. And since the U.S. is functionally a two-party system, it's fairly easy to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. Well, that's absolutely fascinating. I will definitely look at that study. That's interesting about the...
So then, who are you predicting for 2016?
Yeah,
I haven't looked at 2016 yet, but I think I should start, because one of the issues that I've run into is, you know, once it starts to become a matter of kind of national interest, and you know, as you get closer to the date, there's a lot of course, media reports and speculations, and I found that can be very disorienting. So I'd like to look at it before it becomes too much of a discussed item and make a decision at that point.
We'd better hurry then, because...
Exactly.
Is it time for a woman?
I hope so. I think it sounds, from what I understand, that Hillary Clinton is going to run. So I think it's just a question of whether she will be able to win. So,
Nina, I wonder if you... Could you tell us a little bit about how you got into astrology?
Oh, sure. So this is, it's sort of a funny story. I guess it usually is for folks. So I was, I think the way I really got interested in it is I was probably about 10 years old, and I found a book about Chinese astrology. It's a very well-known book. It's Theodore Lau's Chinese zodiac signs. And it's a very well-written book, but it's very rich with information. And so I found it at the bookstore, and my mother bought it for me. And then my grandmother, who was very interested in this stuff too, we just read it together. And we said, ooh, this is totally like, you know, this person we know. And we just went through the whole book and had a really good time with it. And so a couple years after that, I was going home from school, and I found Linda Goodman's Sun Sign, this very, very sketchy used bookstore. And I think it was such a forgotten little bookstore that I think the book might have even been a first edition because nobody just was bothered, you know. And after that, I was just hooked. So I started to learn how to calculate charts, and then I got a little software, and you know, after that,
it's just
history. Yep.
There's like a whole generation of us that owe everything to Linda Goodman.
Linda Goodman, yes, me too,
I think,
right?
So, exactly.
For me, it was Love Signs, but you know.
Yeah, and I've always enjoyed that book as well.
Oh yeah. Yes. Actually, a friend of mine was over once, and she was reading, you know, passages out of it and reading them aloud to, like, the other people in the room. And she looked up at me at one point and she said, "When are you going to write a book? Why are we still referring to Love Signs? This is written in, what, the 70s?
That's so true. Exactly.
There's nothing that's replaced it, you know.
And it's still in print. It's still in print.
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting how it came to be that... I'm always interested in to know how... people came to astrology because no one actually goes to school and gets, oh, you should be an astrologer.
People
always seem to go into it sideways, or they come to a point in their life where they either meet a person or they read Linda Goodman, and that's the turning point. You know, but we can all look back as astrologers and say when it happened for us, I think.
That's so true, Alison. I completely agree.
Yeah.
Well, except for me, but that's just the third generation.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, lucky me.
Oh, yeah. So were you heavily astrologized as a child? As a Virgo, you were?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah.
It was just always a part of the conversation.
That's great, yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. I can't complain.
We're very fortunate that Arwen's mom and grandmother are fans of our podcast and comment for us.
Hey, that's great. Yeah. So if you had like a boyfriend or somebody that you brought home, were you immediately quizzed about his sun sign and his horoscope?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they wouldn't let anyone in the house if they didn't know what sign they were.
Like, oh, he's a Scorpio. No, sorry.
Well, hilariously enough, I have Scorpio rising, and my boyfriend's sun is like literally conjunct within 2 minutes of my ascendant, so... We're both.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's 2 degrees Scorpio, and I've got 2 degrees Scorpio rising. I brought home Aquarians, though, in my friendships in school.
Hey, that's pretty great.
And there were no complaints. My mother likes Aquarians.
Well, no wonder we're talking. So I'm Aquarius with Scorpio rising. So there you go.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. How interesting.
Yeah. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Exactly. I feel right at home.
Perfect. I'm feeling quite overwhelmed with all the Scorpios.
Oh, no.
You have several planets in it yourself.
Yes, I do. Okay, but I can't mention them much.
So how is everybody enjoying the Saturn and Scorpio transit happening right now?
Well, to be honest, I think it's stopping me spending money.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
right.
Not that I was a big spender, even though one might think so being a Leo, but I am beyond frugal, actually, at the moment. I'm taking it to new levels of just turning money over twice before spending and reining it all in. Mm-hmm. And I think that has to do with Saturn controlling debt, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you find it, Nina?
You know, it's been interesting. I can't wait for it to go away because I have a lot of things in fixed signs. So it's not only passing over my Scorpio ascendant, but it's squaring Aquarius moon and opposing my Taurus sun pretty much all at the same, or Taurus moon.
Yeah.
At the same time. So it's, it hasn't been too bad, knock on wood. I think I've been more careful with my health and kind of like getting like little nagging chronic issues treated. I always feel like with Saturn, as long as you kind of face up to things, it's still not fun, but it's better than just ignoring it because then it'll just come back even worse.
That's right. So it has already crossed your ascendant.
It has, right, but it's still it's hanging around the sun and moon pretty much for the rest of the year.
Okay. Yeah. So going through your first house and.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we must have the same thing. Now I'm sitting here looking at it.
When did it go into? Was it 2012?
About a year ago.
12, right? 2012, like November-ish? Yeah, actually. That's a couple of months after I had sort of a... I was off work for 3 weeks and sort of in a panic phase in between assignments. And I wasn't sure when it was going to, you know...
Oh.
Yeah.
Find a new gig. Yeah.
Yeah, and we had just moved... they sold a building out from under us that we lived in before. So we had to move a few months before that. So then we were in a new apartment and then all of a sudden worrying about jobs.
That's a very Saturn experience for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It all worked out though, luckily.
It did, exactly.
Yeah, I just had to sort of wait it out and panic every day.
right. Take your anti-anxiety pills.
Oh my goodness.
You know, and I think if you go into Saturn in Scorpio carrying that, you will be forced to address it.
Mm-hmm. If it's beyond your means, yeah.
Yes. So mm-hmm.
if you go in with no debt and a surplus, that you might have less of a surplus.
That's right.
You know, it's a combination, but it's definitely, because it's Scorpio, it really does have to do with your debt levels as well and how much you're prepared to carry it.
Yeah, sacrifice for security. There's a good
sacrifice
metaphor.
For security.
Oh, that's a good phrase. I like that.
Thank you.
Very true.
So, you know, I mean, I've got it in Saturn's in my fourth house at the moment, moving to the fifth recently, but so I'm not having that first house effect, I think, at all. Yeah.
No, that's good.
Yeah, but I'm just not lashing out like I used to. I'm not, as I say, it's not that I was a big spender, but I was one who would go to the hairdresser once a month. Now I haven't.
Right.
Now I don't do that.
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it's that kind of thing.
Well, I think also, though, I imagine Saturn also teaches you that, you know, even if you have less, whether it's, you know, less health or less money or whatever to play with, you can actually function quite well and be happy. Maybe that's the real lesson.
It's amazing.
You know, it's hard. It's painful.
I've also found a big thing I've been doing is this purging thing of getting rid of the junk.
Mm. Oh, yes.
You know, when we first came to Vancouver,
we had the downsizing.
Oh. We had a 40-foot container that we put in storage just down the road here. And it was sitting there for 12 months before we actually went in and just got rid of it all because we were paying
for storage. It was non-essential, clearly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Stuff we weren't ever going to use again. Endless dinner services and who cooks, you know?
Right. Well, and how many, you know, how often do you have the queen for dinner or, you know, 30 people over or whatever? Yeah.
And eventually we stopped paying the rental on this container and we got rid of the stuff that was in it. But it did linger until something came through. Mm. So that's
interesting.
Way.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
definitely. That's fascinating.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
Not to get off on the topic of Saturn, but it's sort of a Scorpio thing. Just thinking about like different things going over your first house, like you know, it's because it's interesting to look back over your, you know, your history and to go, oh, that's when that was happening. Oh my God,
that's what was going on. That's right.
Like for example, the thing that comes to mind immediately for me is Pluto crossing my ascendant, which of course was back in the 80s. And this was like right when I was going into middle school, since you didn't grow up in the U.S., Allison, but middle school is 6th through 8th grade. So basically puberty, basically like the worst possible time.
It's a really difficult
it's
age.
Horrible.
Right.
Uh-huh. Right. So, of course, Pluto going over your ascendant, what's that going to, you know, cause to happen? Well, you know, but interestingly, by the end of it, I had managed to dye my hair red for the first time from being blonde, naturally. And, you know, wearing a leather jacket around, you know, all these very 80s things, right? But I'm just thinking, like, picture-wise, like, that's, my God, that's right, you know, Pluto on the ascendant. That's hilarious.
Right.
Yeah. And conflicts with bullying girls.
Oh, but, power struggles, right?
Yeah, I was, a bit of a wimp, I guess, but, gosh.
But that's how you learn, right?
Yeah, totally, yeah. It doesn't kill me.
Exactly. That's
exactly
right. No, just kidding. It's very true that planets crossing the ascendant do make changes for you.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, one of the things, too, if maybe this might be an okay segue, is one of the things, so when we had our talk in Vancouver a couple weeks ago, one of the things that people came up and talked to me about individually was just how their charts might have looked. So, for example, that, you know, somebody might have Mars in the second house or Jupiter in the second. Mm-hmm. And it seems that having planets in that second house or, you know, even temporarily when they're transiting or maybe progressing into that house really changes the tenor of one's financial situation.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know. Do you guys have anything in the second house that you want to share?
Neptune.
Oh, I do as well.
Really?
It's okay.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
You've probably got the same chart, really, haven't you?
Oh, my gosh.
In some ways, yeah.
Yeah, Neptune in the second house. Golly.
So what, money just disappears? Or?
Well, I think of it more, I'm afraid to talk about it.
Oh, she's squirming.
I know.
Okay.
There's one.
Sensitive topic.
Afraid to talk about it is one thing. But also, I tend to think of it in, you know, like, if I have a lot of it, it's like, I'm so grateful and thankful to the universe, you know, that it's like, well, you know, I was talking about doing the homeless count and all that stuff and how I,
how I just, you know, I absolutely love to give money to, I just need to say in this publicly, but it's not on the radio, so whatever, but, you know, like, just randomly giving people on the street, like, lots of money, kind of.
Right, hey, that's really
it.
Nice. Yeah,
I mean, I feel like it's so selfish sounding, but I feel like a fantastic person after that.
Well, you know, I'm sure they're not objecting either, so that's pretty great.
Exactly, and I've had friends say, well, you know, they're just going to go and drink with that, and I'm like,
who cares?
What are you going to do with your money? Jesus.
You know? Exactly. Like, I mean, are you using it any better? Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I totally agree. You know, and I think I have, I mean, having Neptune in the second as well, I don't know if it's Neptune or if it's something else, but as a result, I find that I am a little bit more, I don't know if I would say I'm like, you know, wildly generous or anything. I wouldn't go probably that far. But at the same time, I feel like I'm a lot more liberal about that kind of thing. You know, I don't really care what the person is going to do with it because I don't really feel I'm in a place to judge them, right?
Yeah.
I feel like we already do probably a lot of that of homeless people anyway. And, you know, they're just people. They have agency. They can make decisions just
exactly.
as much as anybody. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would consider that sort of a, you know, a compassion thing,
right.
more so than a, you know.
Do you see yourself in the role as the Good Samaritan type thing?
Well, sort of, but it's not like, like I have a friend who says, well, you know, I you know, donate to whatever, you know, organization that helps them get back on their feet. And I'm like, you know, I'm not going to sit them down and give them a lecture about how they could be investing the dollar or $5, you know, or $20. You know, like if he wants to go and do heroin, you know, I feel bad that that's where his life is, but really, you know, it's none of my business. And if it makes me feel better, and if it makes him or her feel better, that I, you know, I'm giving this.
It's probably not good in that way.
Really,
yeah.
You know,
I think it's hard, right? Because, I mean, I feel like, you know, we don't do that same judgment on people who are, say, very wealthy. I mean, I'm sure, you know, in the U.S., there's been an ongoing conversation around, you know, should we pay CEOs 600 or 1,000 times what the average worker makes in their corporation?
Right.
And, you know, nobody's being like, oh, we shouldn't give you $30 million because you'll just blow it on a yacht, you know?
Exactly.
It's not really fair,
you'll
I think.
You'll just bet it on the stock market and lose
That's
it all.
Right.
Tank the economy.
Yeah, or your wife will divorce you and she'll take it all or whatever, right? We should give people the benefit of the doubt, I think.
It's like the cycle of violence. It's like, you know, you just pick on the person that's littler than you in society, you know? Like, we
right.
like we have some kind of control when we're giving someone money on the street. Like, what are you going to do with it?
That's actually very true.
We have
right.
no control over CEOs or politicians and what they do with the money or the world, you know?
Right, but it's certainly easy to moralize when it comes to the homeless people,
yeah.
So do you both have then Sagittarius on your second house cusps?
Mm-hmm, I do, yes.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, what is your what's your Jupiter in? So the traditional, you know, ruler, of course. What is it?
Aquarius.
Aquarius.
There you
okay.
go. That's another.
Yeah, so for you it's in the fourth house, right? Or third. Yeah.
Third actually. Yeah.
Third. Yeah. Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? So maybe your money comes from a third house kind of activity.
I do.
That's something to think
writing.
About. Yeah, absolutely.
Editing and yeah, definitely.
Right. And then if you have aspects to it, that might tell you a bit more about, you know, your attitude to money or how easily it comes, things like that.
Square Mars.
Oh, yeah. Is it Square Mars?
Yeah, Square Mars and Taurus.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So, and well, see, there you could go into this interesting kind of maybe psychological thing. You're like, okay, you know, I think it's a very generous aspect because I think there's a certain, I don't know, maybe impulsiveness to that. You know, Mars and Jupiter just wants to expand. But I also can see situations arising in your financial life that are fairly dramatic, right? Like you might get like a windfall one time, but then another time, well, the building gets sold from under you and you don't have a job and, you know, things like that.
Exactly. Yes, definitely.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think that adds to the whole thing of like when things are going well, you know, to think of it as like, not like temporary. I'm not one of these, oh, well, you know, I, whatever.
Yeah.
It's,
right.
You know, just,
but you don't get too attached either.
Sort of, yeah. It's almost like, well, this is just as, you know, capricious as misfortune.
That's right. Well, that sounds pretty healthy. And I think a Renaissance thinker would definitely agree with that because they were very much in believing in the goddess Fortuna, you know, the blind goddess who spins the wheel. So, you know, I think there was very much, that was part of the conversation around wealth and success back then.
Totally. That reminds me of, I don't know if you've seen J.K. Rowling, the lady that wrote Eat, Pray, Love.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I forget her name.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah, right. Elizabeth Gilbert. If you've seen her TED Talk, it's It's amazing. No. She talks about the genie, the muse.
The muse, yes. Right. Oh. And how
we,
muse.
Right. These days we think of the muse as, you know, that's just a metaphor and it's, you know, toil and, you know, you're just, you're a thing of your own and it's you. And, you know, how much pressure that is for an artist or a writer or anyone that's trying to produce or create anything. And she says, you know, it's sort of like it would be better if we thought of it the way that the you know they did in ancient times, where the muse just either comes into you and you know wants to speak through you, or they don't, you know, and it's
right.
Not,
you don't have all that control, right?
Right, and sometimes you know there's a poem that just wants to be written, and it you know
it will flow through you. Yeah.
Some beautiful examples. I totally recommend that. Type.
Oh yeah, thank you. I'll definitely check it out. Yeah, you know, and I think maybe also to Allison's earlier question, that can be a larger difference in how modern and traditional astrology can differ. I think the traditional approach was much more, you know, if things want to happen to you, they will. Mm. You might have some control. You still have free will because, of course, since these people are mostly writing out of a Christian context, you have to have free will in that theology. Right, but at the same time, you know, it doesn't mean that you're necessarily using it or that you're spiritually evolved enough to really know what to do with it. So you might still be very much compelled by the stars. And so I think they just saw that kind of like fortuna, you know, like if it wants to happen, well, it will. And there's not a whole lot you can probably do to stop it unless you're a very, very holy person.
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. Now we're all in lost in thought.
Exactly. So how about you, Allison? Do you want to share what your second half is like?
I've got Pluto.
You don't have to. I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Okay, you put me on the spot. Pluto in the second, but Leo on the cusp, so...
So the sun in Leo, yeah. I see. So it's that's also in the second or near the
no,
second
the
somewhere.
First.
Oh, I see. So that would be very good for money, right?
Well, I mean, I keep believing so.
Yeah, keep remember us little people when it happens for you.
Yeah, but this is what, you know, people have always had the impression that, impression is really the word, that, you know, somehow I have more money than I do. Everyone always thinks that, you know, when they look at
right, me. Right. So you might get hit up for loans, though not necessarily be in a position to actually give them out.
Yeah. Well, right. Actually, we spoke about this a while ago, how Owen and I spoke about this a few months back, about how I find that people throughout life have often come to borrow money from us.
Never had that happen, really.
And it's because the perception is... Leo, Pluto, I don't know, that we've got it to lying around doing nothing, you know.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. And whereas when I've had money to, you know, if I've known that a friend of mine was in trouble or whatever, I've just given them like a large heap of money.
As much as you could, yeah.
Yeah, right. It just, you know, here, you know, and then run away, sort of thing, you know. Here and help yourself, do something, run away.
We've often had the most unlikely person will come up to you, and people you know and have known for a few years, will suddenly be asking for just a loan, to whatever it is. And so this cropped up for us, me and my husband, I'm talking about several times recently, in the recent past, should I say. And we actually got to the stage where we don't loan people money, we just give it to them, and that's the
right.
end of the karmic
right.
debt.
Right, it's in all
them.
Or nothing, kind of.
Yes, so that if somebody wanted, you know, $500 to get through the month, we just give it. And I'm not saying phone in because I'm not going to, but that kind of the impression has always been that we have more than we do.
That's an interesting thing, though, like that's having that as your approach, your you know, moving forward, this is our, you know, this is how we'll do it, because in David Graeber's book Debt, the first 5,000 years, Nina, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but
no, that sounds fascinating. Oh, though amazing. It's fairly recent, right?
Yeah, he is one of the people who, well, he's actually the person that coined the phrase the 99% in the whole
occupying.
Okay. And he put out this book in like late 2012.
We'll put a note on the site when we put the
totally. We'll put a link to it. It's a great book. It's so interesting. But it basically is the history of debt
and
saying money.
What?
The whole myth of like people used to, you know, trade like, okay, I've got 6 chickens and I want 1 cow, so here you go, and I'll take the cow. And then, you know, eventually that was too onerous because maybe you didn't have, you know, 6 whole chickens, or you didn't want a whole cow at the time.
Got one with the left wing.
They then, you know, started to write it down on a piece of paper. And he says that that's completely fallacious. Like, it's not at all, like, historically proven that that is how, you know, money and debt evolved. And, you know, it's mostly to do with standing armies and how they would feed and clothe them and, you know, whatever.
Okay.
and how that's how coins, you know, eventually became a thing. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the whole point of it is just the idea that instead it's more of a gift, you know, economy where you, you know, oh, here, you know, you need a cow, so here, have this cow, but I know that you raise chickens, so when I need chickens, you know,
The implicit agreement is that you'll do the same for me.
And people didn't move around a lot. It was, you know, feudalism, for, you know, and before that it was just whatever, you know.
Right.
Home on the range sort of thing. And everyone knew where everyone was. It's not like, you know, someone's going to disappear with his cows and his...
Right, the ultimate accountability, right?
Right.
So, yeah, it's so funny. The perception of money is almost as powerful as the actual cash itself, right?
Oh, yeah, because we're coming back to that with the internet, right? Like, no one's going to, you know, disappear on you anymore because you can always find them online.
Right, yeah. That's true.
Weird. Well, gosh, maybe we should do book reviews?
All right, well...
But let's talk about your book.
Okay, Arwen and I are big readers. So anyway, the book I've brought to review this time is Planets in Solar Returns, A Yearly Guide for Transformation and Growth by Mary Shear. And this is an excellent book for solar returns. A solar return is a chart that an astrologer will cast for your birthday each year. So every year you get older, you get a new solar return chart on your birthday. That's just what solar returns are. And this is the book about interpreting the solar return chart, because clearly we still have a natal chart which stays with us and is really the backbone of all our astrology. But for forecast work, the solar return was something that you can have done on your birthday by your astrologer, and it will give a specific forecast for 12 months ahead only. So Nina, I don't know if you use solar returns in your work.
Oh, very heavily, and I use them maybe in a little different way than modern astrologers do, but I'm very familiar with the book you referenced, and I think it's a great tool.
Yeah, it's a great book. So Arwen is our... I was going to say our webmistress, that's not exactly that. Well, yes, are you?
That could be, yeah.
You could be, she's the main
one. You're open to that, all right.
Yeah.
So we'll get that up there. And yes, and you don't have a... Not this time.
Not this time, yeah. And go ahead and recommend Nina's website and...
You need to, do Nina, do share with us if somebody would like to contact you. Perhaps email or... website address for us,
please. Right. So yes, yeah, so the website is griffonastrology.com, and that's GRYPHON astrology.com. There are a lot of articles, and there's a blog. I maintain a blog, so there are probably about 500 pages there. So there's a lot to go through, and to kind of get lost in. I do a lot of book reviews as well, mostly traditional books and translations. And if somebody wants to reach me, they can just email me at nina@griffonastrology.com.
Yes, we'd like to thank our guest, Nina Griffon, for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Allison. It's been a pleasure. And Arwen. And Roger.
Thank you so much, Nina. Well, this has been the Access Astrology Podcast. Our guest has been Nina Griffon. Our podcast is produced and recorded by Roger Arantos. I'm Arwen O'Neill.
And I'm Allison Price.
And thank you so much for joining us.
We'll see you next time.